Hello, this is Mike Renzi, co-host of the podcast, and I would like to welcome you to the October issue of Derm Surgery Digest and the Beyond the Digest supplemental podcast. The October issue of Dermatologic Surgery is highlighted by a retrospective cohort study evaluating the rate of positive surgical margins after standard excision of adnexal tumors and factors associated with margin positivity. There is also a nice review on the diagnosis and management of acral pigmented lesions, which includes some valuable dermatoscopic images and descriptions. Within the cosmetic portion of the journal, there is a split-face study to compare the efficacy of autologous injectable platelet-rich fibrin with microneedling against microneedling alone in atrophic acne scars. As always, thank you for listening and have a happy surgery day.
This segment of the episode features surgical oncology and reconstructive article reviews.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the original article titled Evaluating Rates of Positive Margins After Standard Excision of Cutaneous Adnexal Malignancies by authors Sheriglou, Dudikin, Crisito, Stevenson, and Carucci. The incidence of adnexal neoplasms has been increasing, but these neoplasms remain rare, with approximately 5 cases per 1 million person years in the U.S. Due to their heterogeneity and rarity, most studies are retrospective with limited cases at a single institution. Case series reporting the successful use of Mohs surgery have been published. However, due to the lack of outcome measures for the treatment of these cancers, it has been argued that wide local excisions are equivalently effective. As such, the study aimed to provide subtype and site-specific estimates of positive margins after standard excision. Of those excised in the National Cancer Database, 59.8% were treated with wide local excision, documented as greater than or equal to 1 centimeter margins, while the rest were excised with narrow margins. The most common subtypes were sebaceous and porocarcinoma, whereas the least common were sporadenocarcinoma and eccrine papillary adenocarcinoma. I would refer the reader to Table 2 to evaluate the positive margin rates for each subtype stratified by site. Overall, of all subtypes, positive margins were noted in 8.4% of tumors on the head and neck, compared to 3.2% on the trunk and extremities. MAC was most commonly excised with positive margins at 10.8%. When stratified by site, positive margins were noted to be the most for eccrine adenocarcinoma on the head and neck, and MAC for the trunk and extremities. Factors associated with increased risk of positive margins included head and neck location, larger clinical T stage, and excision with less than 1 centimeter margins. MAC, eccrine adenocarcinoma, and apocrine adenocarcinoma also had higher likelihood of positive margins. Notably, those with positive margins had significantly poorer overall survival. Over the years evaluated, narrow margin excision and Mohs surgery have increased in utilization. Mohs was most likely to be used for head and neck tumors, older patients, lower T stages, and in academic or high volume centers. Notably, the rate of positive margins on the head and neck for these adnexal tumors is similar to that of invasive SCC, where Mohs or staged excision with complete margin assessment are the treatment of choice. There are currently no NCCN guidelines for adnexal tumors, and the only expert consensus guidelines from 2019 only comment on utilizing Mohs surgery or complete margin assessment for MAC. For all other subtypes, they recommend Mohs or standard excision with some suggestion that wide versus narrow margins can be used interchangeably. The authors suggest that given the high rates of margin positivity for head and neck adnexal tumors and certain subtypes on the trunk and extremities, it may be prudent to excise these neoplasms with Mohs or with complete margin assessment. Of note, the study did not comment on local recurrence or disease-specific survival.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the review article Perianal Malignancies, a review for the Dermatologic Surgeon by authors Corey Kosh and Anthony Rossi. This is a review article that describes the 4 most common perianal malignancies: squamous cell carcinoma, basal cell carcinoma, melanoma, and extramammary Paget disease. Most of the article talks about SCC, as this is the most common type of perianal cancer. This is most often associated with HPV, particularly strains 16 and 18. History of immunosuppression, STIs, and history of receptive anal intercourse are risk factors. It can also occur in the setting of chronic inflammation, such as in perianal HS or lichen sclerosis. It is recommended that patients with perianal SCC be referred to a clinic where anal cytology, similar to a pap smear, can be performed. The guidelines for anal SCC include staging imaging to assess for local and distant metastases. NCCN guidelines recommend surgical excision with 1 centimeter margins for well-differentiated SCC less than 2 centimeters, although reported recurrence rates are high and Mohs is recommended by the AUC. In contrast, basal cell carcinomas of the perianal region are not associated with HPV. Surgical management is standard for these tumors, and Mohs is the recommended modality by the AUC. Anorectal melanoma is a type of mucosal melanoma and is quite rare. These are often diagnosed at a later stage and have a poor prognosis, and they unfortunately do not respond as well to immunotherapy. Lastly, perianal extramammary Paget disease can be primary or in association with an underlying internal malignancy, in this location, most likely colorectal adenocarcinoma. Diagnosis may be delayed as Pagets can be confused for inflammatory or infectious processes. Screening for underlying malignancy is recommended, which in this location should always include age-appropriate colonoscopy. Mohs is the recommended surgical treatment as there are high reported recurrence rates even with very wide margin excision. Non-surgical treatments may include photodynamic therapy, radiation, and topicals such as imiquimod. Overall, this is a useful review article as perianal malignancies are very much in the scope of practice of dermatologic surgeons, but we may not be as familiar with tumors at this site.
This is Dr. Ashley Decker reviewing the original investigation, Wound Care Adherence in Mohs Micrographic Surgery, a prospective cohort study by first author Ryan Chen and senior author Basil Mahmoud. Previous studies have shown low treatment adherence within general dermatology, but this has never been studied in the context of adherence to postoperative wound care instructions within dermatologic surgery. This study aimed to determine the frequency and causes of wound care non-adherence in patients who underwent Mohs surgery at a single site by one surgeon. In this prospective cohort study, patients were asked to participate in the study at routine wound care visits 1 to 2 weeks after Mohs. Wound care adherence was measured using a modified 8-item Morisky Medication Adherence Scale, MMAS, consisting of 8 questions with a score range of 0 to 8, with 8 being most adherent. The questionnaire also included the Frail Scale, which is a 5-question assessment of fatigue, resistance, aerobic capacity, illnesses, and weight loss. Adverse postoperative events were also recorded. Primary outcome was the modified MMAS 8 adherence score and association between adherence and individual variables. Secondary outcome measure was the incidence of postoperative complications, and secondary analysis consisted of association between adherence and fragility and complications. A total of 63 patients completed the study, with 70% of patients demonstrating high adherence to postoperative wound care instructions. There was only 1 adverse event in the cohort. Older age and wound care assistants were significant predictors for high adherence, with frailty associated with low adherence. Overall, this study does suggest that that wound care adherence is higher for patients that have assistance with wound care, and enlisting the help of a family member, friend, or clinical aide in the first couple of weeks in the postoperative period may be helpful. Patients with higher fragility scores were less likely to adhere to wound care instructions. Therefore, screening patients prior to surgery may be helpful.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the original investigation, Diagnosis and Management of Acral Pigmented Lesions, first author Jenny Ingracia, senior author Tracy Liebman. Survival outcomes in acral lentiginous melanoma are worse than for cutaneous melanoma, and diagnostic delays are likely a contributing factor. Authors here provide a comprehensive review of the diagnosis and management of acral pigmented lesions by performing a literature review, primarily original research, involving the clinical and dermoscopic features and the management frameworks for acquired and congenital melanocytic nevi, acral melanosis, non-melanocytic pigmented lesions, and acral lentiginous melanoma. The authors discussed assessment of acquired acral melanocytic nevi. Within the United States, these nevi have an estimated prevalence of up to 36% in patients with darker colored skin, and they tend to occur at different sites from acral melanomas. In adults, benign lesions are more likely to occur on non-weight-bearing region of the sole, such as the arch, while acral melanomas are more likely to occur on weight-bearing aspect of the foot, such as the heel. over 75% of acral nevi will exhibit at least one major benign dermoscopic pattern, the most prevalent patterns being the parallel furrow, followed by the lattice-like, and then the fibrillar pattern. The fibrillar pattern is most common on pressure-bearing areas, and the lattice-like pattern occurs more frequently on the arch. Like acquired nevi, congenital acral nevi may display major benign patterns. The globular pattern is more common in congenital acral nevi than in acquired nevi. Often multiple dots or globules are arranged linearly along the furrows or the ridges, as seen in the crista dotted pattern. The most prevalent pattern observed in congenital acral nevi is the combination of the parallel furrow and the crista dotted pattern, coined the peas in the pod pattern. With regard to acral lentiginous melanomas, risk factors include age over 50 and a lesion diameter of over 7 millimeters. Acral lentiginous melanomas are more common on the plantar foot than on the palmar surface, and the heel is the most common site for acral melanomas to develop. The parallel ridge pattern has been described as the most characteristic pattern of acral lentiginous melanoma. Parallel ridge pattern presents as pigmented lines along the ridges. The sensitivity and specificity of the parallel ridge pattern is 86% and 99% respectively. Irregular diffuse pigmentation is a highly sensitive and specific marker of more advanced acral melanomas. Acral melanosis often presents as multiple brown, relatively monomorphic, and evenly pigmented macules on the palms and soles, resulting in a mottled appearance, and is more common in darker Fitzpatrick skin types. Dermoscopy of acral melanosis usually displays regular borders and even pigmentation. Of note, the line that separates acral from non-acral sites is referred to as the Wallace line and represents a transition zone. Lesions that traverse this zone may seem atypical as they display patterns characteristic of both acral and non-acral sites. It is of critical importance to be able to differentiate between the furrows and the ridges of volar skin. The furrow ink test can help and can be performed before dermoscopy if the clinician can't distinguish where the pigment lies. In this method, the lesion is marked with a liquid ink that's allowed to penetrate for a few seconds. The ink is wiped away, revealing residual ink within the furrows. Small acral lesions that don't display characteristic benign patterns but do not display the parallel ridge pattern may benefit from short-term digital dermoscopic monitoring. Authors suggest 3-month intervals for short-term monitoring. If a biopsy is warranted, careful consideration is important in this site. Excisional biopsies for a suspected melanoma may be a first choice on other anatomic locations. However, given the discomfort associated, authors recommend a partial punch or incisional biopsy. For a larger lesion, sampling the most atypical portion is recommended. Superficial shave is not recommended given the thick stratum corneum and risk of missing the pathology. The dermoscopic images are instructive in this article and definitely worth reviewing. And figure 5 is worth taking a look at as it is a concise synthesis of the proposed framework for the management of acral pigmented lesions.
This is Christy Regula reviewing performance and quality measure selection by Mohs surgeons in the 2020 Merit-Based Incentive Payment System by first author Christian Grunbeck and senior author Hao Feng. Medicare's Quality Payment Program, or QPP, was first established in 2012 to promote high-value care by linking physician reimbursement to various performance measures. Physicians participate in one of two tracks, the Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, or MIPS, or the Advanced Alternative Payment Models, APMs. Under the MIPS framework, which is used by most of the dermatologists, individuals are eligible for an annual payment adjustment, either positive or negative, based on their performance across four domains. Those domains are quality, cost, improvement, activities, and promoting interoperability. Clinicians participating in advanced APMs are excluded from MIPS reporting and are subject to a unique cost and quality incentive structure. Dermatologists overall have demonstrated increased MIPS engagement and improved performance since its initiation in 2017. This study aimed to describe MIPS performance and measure selection by Mohs surgeons in the 2020 performance period, which is important given the increasing potential payment adjustment, now negative 9% to positive 9%. Stated efforts by the American College of Mohs Surgery to develop Mohs-specific quality measures are in place, and the approaching transition towards a more streamlined specialty-specific incentive payment system makes this very relevant. In this study, final MIPS scores and quality measures reported by groups and individuals in the 2020 performance year were obtained from the Medicare QPP datasets. And this data was linked by clinician NPI numbers to dermatologists in the 2019 Medicare Part B provider set. Final MIPS scores from a range of 0 to 100 were correlated with expected payment adjustments among specific subgroups of Mohs surgeons. So in 2020, final MIPS scores were calculated based on quality, 55%, promoting interoperability, 30%, and improvement activities, 15%. Those were the categories it was based on. MIPS scores less than the performance threshold of 45 equate to a negative payment adjustment. Those meeting this threshold translate to a neutral adjustment, and those exceeding the threshold correspond to a positive adjustment. So during this time frame, scores were available for 8,778 of 12,018 dermatologists and 2,148 of 2,597 Mohs surgeons in the Part B provider set. Mohs surgeons predominantly submitted as groups, 51.6%, or individuals, 36.4%, and less frequently submitted through APMs, 12%. As determined through final MIPS scores, 77.4% of Mohs surgeons exceeded the performance threshold and will receive a positive payment adjustment, and only 0.3% will receive a negative payment adjustment. There were 22.3% who will receive a neutral payment adjustment. ACMS members, who accounted for 53.1% of Mohs surgeons in the sample, were also more likely to meet the exceptional performance threshold than those that were not, 71.5% to 59%. At least one quality measure related to dermatology or Mohs surgery was reported by most individuals, 92%, and dermatology groups, yet less frequently by multi-specialty groups and hospitals. General non-derm specific quality measures may be easier to report, conveniently assessed by office staff, and possibly promote general well-being, but they are not directly related to dermatologic care, and it's unclear from this data how or whether they can improve care for this patient population. Importantly, there are a growing number of additional dermatology and Mohs-related quality measures reportable through dermatology QCDRs, which are qualified clinical data registries, that are not available in the public Medicare data sets. Specifically, ACMS members are eligible to report through Mosaic Registry, which in 2020 offered 10 measures assessing adherence to Mohs appropriate use criteria, management of perioperative antibiotics and non-opioid pain management, utilization of emergency services after skin reconstruction, and rates of surgical site infection. Additional measures created in 2022 assess utilization of anatomical mapping to avoid wrong site surgery and continuation of anticoagulation therapy during office-based skin cancer resections. ACMS and non-ACMS members can also report through DataDerm, which is the AAD's QCDR, which also contains measures that assess dermatologic surgery. Although utilization and performance on these QCDR measures is not publicly available, the fact that most Mohs surgeons reported non-QCDR measures suggests there may be utilization barriers or lack of familiarity with QCDR reporting. Furthermore, Mohs surgeons in multi-specialty groups and hospitals rarely reported any dermatology or Mohs-specific measures, suggesting those in large group may lack autonomy in measure selection. Further studies will be needed to comprehensively assess utilization of these QCDR measures and any utilization barriers that exist. But I do think that it's worth looking into some of these QCDRs to identify more specific measures to our practice.
This is Dr. Ashley Decker reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, repair of a defect involving the nasal ala, alar sulcus, nasal sidewall, and medial cheek by first author Brett Schaefer and senior author Jessalyn Tate.
In this reconstructive conundrum, an 81-year-old woman underwent Mohs surgery for a melanoma in situ on the right medial face. The final defect measured 2.5 by 4 centimeters, involving the nasal sidewall, nasal ala, alar sulcus, and medial cheek. Due to the size of the lesion and number of subunits involved, a multi-stage, multi-flap repair was chosen to maximize functional and cosmetic outcome. I invite the listeners to view a photo of the defect in the journal. First, a mulolabial interpolated flap was designed to address the nasal ala and the alar sulcus. However, a significant portion of the defect involved the medial cheek, which affected the design of the interpolated flap pedicle. The authors decided to advance the cheek medially to repair the cheek portion of the defect using the inferior tissue cone as the reservoir for the mulolabial interpolated flap. To ensure a well-vascularized pedicle, the interpolation flap incision lines were designed in a V shape medially along the nasolabial fold and laterally at the edge of the cheek defect with the inferior extension to the lower cheek. The interpolated flap was elevated and thinned, rotated superior medially 90 degrees, and secured into place with tacking sutures placed to preserve the alar sulcus. The remaining primary defect on the cheek and secondary defect from the interpolated flap were advanced medially and sutured into place. To close the nasal sidewall portion of the defect, a rhombic transposition flap was designed with the incision lines placed superiorly along the nasal sidewall. Takedown of the mulolabial interpolated flap was performed at 3 weeks post-op, and the patient underwent dermabrasion and a small scar revision to improve minor blunting of the alar groove at 6 months post-op. This reconstructive conundrum provides a good example of how multi-subunit defects should be repaired utilizing a multi-repair approach to target each involved subunit to optimize cosmesis and function.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing The Reconstructive Conundrum, Repair of a Posterior Alar Base Defect by authors Hannah Wang and Jose Cervantes. The defect is a 1 by 0.9 centimeter defect of the posterior alar base, also involving a little of the apical triangle of the upper cutaneous lip. The authors chose a V to Y advancement flap with the base of the triangle abutting the alar base and the apex of the triangle along the nasolabial fold. A tacking suture was used to secure the base of the flap to the piriform aperture, which lifted the leading edge of the flap to recreate the alar base. This case highlights how basic workhorse flaps, such as the V to Y flap, with appropriate use of tacking sutures, can help recreate cosmetic subunits.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the communication and approach for Mohs excisions for sebaceous carcinoma of the posterior lamella. First author Brett Neal, senior author Justin Leitenberger. Most, about 75 to 80% of sebaceous carcinomas of the eyelid arise from the meibomian glands of the posterior lamella, and the upper eyelid is more commonly affected than the lower eyelid. The eyelids can be divided into the anterior and posterior lamella. The anterior lamella consists of skin and the orbicularis oculi muscle, and the posterior lamella consists of the tarsal plate and the palpebral conjunctiva. An anterior approach to the Mohs excision would compromise the anterior lamella and potentially more of the tarsal plate than is necessary, jeopardizing upper eyelid function and leading to more complex repairs. As such, the authors described a posterior approach with upper eyelid eversion that is helpful in tissue sparing for these cases. For clinical exam, eyelid eversion can be performed quickly by placing a cotton tip applicator at the superior border of the upper eyelid tarsal plate, about 1 centimeter above the lid margin, while grasping the upper eyelash's lid margin and reflecting that over the applicator. Once the tumor is identified to be of posterior lamellar origin, the posterior approach to Mohs can be performed. The posterior approach that authors describe starts with a suture placed at the lash line of the involved upper eyelid. Next, the blunt, rounded edge of a scalpel handle is applied to the anterior surface of the eyelid. The combination results in effective eversion and subsequent revealing of the posterior lamella, as well as countertraction and a stable platform to allow for an accurate Mohs excision. Alternatively, a Demare retractor or shoehorn speculum can be used to evert the upper eyelid in lieu of the scalpel handle if you have access to them. The use of an eye shield is optional because the scalpel handle itself acts as a protective barrier for the globe. And I think the photo included shows how easily a posterior lamella lesion can be assessed and accessed during a Mohs procedure.
This is Christy Regula reviewing How We Do It, handheld Woods flashlight for surgical site identification prior to Mohs surgery, by first author Abraham Abdulik and senior author Ali Khan Samani. The accurate identification of biopsy sites before dermatologic surgery can be challenging. Wrong site surgery is the leading cause of litigation against dermatologic surgeons and is identified as a major patient safety issue by the AAD. Patients often have difficulty identifying biopsy spots, and referral photographs are sometimes unfocused, obscure, or not available at all. This article presents the use of a handheld 365-nanometer Woods flashlight to assist in surgical site identification. Upon shining the flashlight on the biopsy region in question, a distinct circular fluorescence, the biopsy site, will become well delineated due to increased chromophores of melanin and hemoglobin. In addition, on most head and neck sites, distinct dropout of the orange-red fluorescence of piacnes within follicular ostia can be appreciated at the biopsy scar. There are several limitations to this method. First, it is less helpful on biopsy scars that are older than 6 months. Second, you must obtain sufficient darkness in the room to appreciate the fluorescence. To help with this, you can also cup your hand around the lesion to prevent too much light. Finally, there could be some enhancement of background noise in patients that have rosacea or seborrhea. Although a small learning curve does exist, users quickly become proficient at identifying biopsy sites through this method. So it's best to practice on obvious biopsy sites when you're initially trying to learn the method to serve as a positive control when you're looking for more inconspicuous sites. So when combined with photographs, clinical examination, and patient participation, this technique helps avoid wrong site surgeries while increasing confidence in surgical site identification. Please reference the article for the exact flashlight used, and it can be purchased on Amazon, so it's relatively easy to obtain.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the communication article, County-Based Population Survey of the Mohs Micrographic Surgery and Dermatologic Oncology Fellowship Locations by authors Jennifer Jacobs, Chandler Rundle, Colby Presley, and Christopher Stamey. The authors begin by describing the increasing diversity of the United States and how it is imperative that Mohs fellowship training reflect this population diversity. This study notably focused on Mohs fellowship exposure to lower socioeconomic status populations by evaluating the demographics of the fellowship's location by county. Specifically, counties were evaluated by median annual income, percent of persons living below the poverty line, and median value of owner-occupied housing units. I would refer the reader to Table 1 for exact fellowship locations and figures. However, the top 10 and lowest 10 counties had statistically significant differences in all three categories previously mentioned. Although the authors do acknowledge that many programs may serve patients from outside their county, they propose many important points in their discussion. Patient populations during fellowship can drastically alter the experience, as lower socioeconomic status has a large impact on healthcare utilization, treatment availability, patient adherence, later presentation of cancer, and at times, poorer outcomes. They urge fellowship applicants to consider their future practice and gain greater insight into a fellowship's patient population. They also recommend considering the various service-related activities they may participate in to better understand and serve the diverse patients they may encounter in their careers.
This is Dr. Ashley Decker reviewing the communication, a comparison of international normalized ratio determined by point of care to standard laboratory testing before Mohs micrographic surgery, a prospective single-centered study by Riley Moody and Ramona Bashad. Warfarin is one of the most widely prescribed anticoagulants, and it is common to continue warfarin for Mohs to avoid serious adverse thrombotic events. Warfarin interacts with commonly prescribed drugs, over-the-counter supplements, and food, and close monitoring measuring the international normalized ratio, or INR, is required to determine levels in the blood and adequately assess perioperative bleeding risk. If the INR is greater than 3.5, most dermatologic surgeons agree that you should not proceed with surgery. However, INR levels are labile, and preoperative testing may differ from the patient's actual INR on the day of surgery. The objective of this study was to determine if significant differences exist in the blood INR of patients on warfarin obtained on the day of surgery compared to their most recently measured blood INR. 37 patients were enrolled in the study, and no significant difference was found between the most recent INR and point-of-care INR on the day of surgery. However, the point-of-care INR did impact the decision to proceed with surgery in approximately 19% of cases. Four of these cases were postponed because the INR was super therapeutic on point-of-care testing. Three cases proceeded because point-of-care INR was within therapeutic range, whereas the most recent blood INR was not. Although there was no statistical difference, the authors hypothesized this is due to the small sample size, as out-of-range levels were detected in 10.8% of patients on day of point-of-care testing. There does seem to be some utility in point-of-care testing. However, further studies are needed. I would also like to know within what time period the INR was checked prior to surgery. In my practice, we checked INR within 1 week of surgery. However, due to a large number of possible interactions, it is possible for that to change by the day of surgery.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the communication trigeminal neuralgia following Mohs micrographic surgery by authors Alexandria Riopel and Carl Schonbacher. This is the case report of a 43-year-old man who presented for Mohs on the left cheek, repaired with an advancement flap. 10 days later, he presented with excruciating pain at the incision site, as well as upper and lower molars and radiating to the orbit, with the pain presenting in episodes that each lasted a few minutes. He was referred to neurology, and after imaging ruled out other conditions, he was diagnosed with trigeminal neuralgia due to maxillary and mandibular nerve branch trauma. The condition was unfortunately quite debilitating for the patient, as he could not tolerate carbamazepine and declined surgical decompression. His severe symptoms were still very much impacting his quality of life, unfortunately, at the 8-month postoperative follow-up. In the discussion, the authors describe that the exact etiology of trigeminal neuralgia is unknown. It is a clinical diagnosis with the criteria of presenting with recurrent episodes of unilateral pain in the trigeminal distribution, pain that lasts seconds to minutes and is severe and has a shock-like or sharp quality, and pain that is precipitated by innocuous stimuli. All of these criteria must be present. This case report presents a rare but debilitating complication of Mohs surgery that surgeons should be able to recognize and refer urgently to neurology.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the communication article Reconstruction of Defects on the Nipple Areola Complex by authors Motosko, Dong, Kirstner, and Nouri. The Nipple Areola Complex, or NAC, is of exceptional psychological importance to patients and can rarely be the location of cutaneous malignancies. The authors describe the importance for the use of Mohs surgery in these instances to preserve tissue and maximize cosmesis. A summary of their recommendations are as follows. Small defects are best closed linearly, oriented radially from the center of the NAC. When the nipple is involved, a purse string closure can recreate the cobblestone texture. If the defect involves most of the NAC, the CV flap represented in Figure 1 and its variants are favored for recreating the projection of the nipple. The areola can be reconstructed using a full thickness skin graft. However, pigmentary fading with this technique has made post-operative tattooing the areolar reconstructive method of choice. If possible, nipple sharing techniques utilizing the contralateral nipple tissue can be useful if the donor can accommodate a 50% reduction in volume and height. Although some studies have been done to characterize the average size, color, and projection of the NAC in males and females, the authors suggest utilizing the contralateral NAC as a blueprint for reconstruction due to the wide anatomic variety between individuals.
This segment of the episode features general dermatologic surgery and cosmetic article reviews.
This is Ardalan Minocchetti describing the manuscript, A Split-Face Study to Evaluate Efficacy of Autologous Injectable Platelet-Rich Fibrin with Microneedling against Microneedling with Normal Saline as a Placebo Control in Atrophic Acne Scars. This manuscript comes from our colleagues in Thane and Pune, India. As a background, acne scars, as we know, cause significant stress for our patients. We have many options to treat, but the authors looked at autologous injectable platelet-rich fibrin as a novel option. They describe platelet-rich fibrin, or IPRF, as a second-generation platelet concentrate first developed and used in oral and maxillofacial surgery. Fibrin plays a potential role in platelet aggregation, and the fibrin matrix demonstrates the additional property of angiogenesis and has a role in the first cicatricial matrix of the injured site. Many of us are aware of PRP, or platelet-rich plasma, and the advantages of PRF over PRP, the authors state, is that PRF does not need an anticoagulant and can be prepared more quickly. PRF leads to a steady and higher total growth factor release, and the morphology of PRF is retained over 10 days, whereas PRP leads to an early, shorter release of growth factors and appears to get dissolved from the injection site within a week after treatment. So the authors did a split-face prospective study in 40 patients with atrophic acne scars, 20 men and 20 women. Fitzpatrick scores were 3 and 4. Most patients were in their early 20s. The scale used was the Goodman and Barron qualitative scale for acne scars. Patients had to have the same grade on both sides of the face and had to have no real cosmetic treatments within the past 12 weeks. The right side of the face was injected with the autologous PRF. Details of the PRF preparation were shown and described in the manuscript. The tubes are shown in figure 1. The control side of the face was the left side, and those patients had normal saline injected. The PRF was injected within 15 minutes of preparation. Both the saline and PRF were injected with a 20-gauge needle. Dermapen was used as the microneedling device. They had 4 sessions, monthly treatments. Follow-up was done at 2 months. And the results on the scale of the GB scale, or Goodman and Barron scale, really showed that there was a significant decrease in the scale number on the study side. Table 1 shows the results beautifully, where if you look, at 24 weeks, there's a 57.4 decrease in the scale as compared with the control side, a 3.6% decrease. Satisfaction scores were also measured. They were significantly higher for the treatment, or the PRF side, as compared to the left. And also subdivision of the specific scars showed that rolling scars responded best, a 38.75% improvement as compared with boxcar and ice pick scars. The authors highlight that to date, no split face study has been published comparing the efficacy of microneedling with injectable PRF against microneedling alone with placebo control. So this was the novelty of this manuscript. And they conclude that injectable PRF with microneedling is more effective in the management of atrophic acne scars when compared with microneedling alone, rolling scars showing the best improvement as compared with boxcar scars. It's novel and safe, transient side effects, and this is something that can be explored in the future as a simple, cost-effective procedure for acne scarring.
This is Deirdre Hooper reviewing an interim 6-month analysis of the dermatologic effects and midface volume correction with XTRCL filler in a prospective single center study by first author Giovanni Salti and lead author Martina Manni. This was a phase 4 study evaluating a filler out of Italy called Definesse. This is a HA filler that has high G prime, intermediate cohesivity, and very low tan delta, and it's meant to be injected deeply. In this prospective, non-comparative, single-center study, 50 women aged 40 to 60 years old underwent 1 injection session followed by a touch-up at month 1. They used supraperiosteal boluses in the mid-face, which they describe as the Pegasus technique and is well illustrated in figure 2. They used an average of 4.2 mLs of filler over the 2 injection sessions, and they followed these patients. When you look at the results in the GAIS, 100% improvement was seen at 6 months by the investigators and 94% by the patients. The investigators graded the improvement slightly higher. The majority were very much improved or much improved, while the patients graded themselves the majority improved or much improved. What was interesting was they also had a significant improvement in skin density and a mild but significant improvement in skin thickness as measured by high-frequency echography.
In the questionnaires, 100% of subjects noted that they found their skin to be firmer. So in the discussion, the authors comment that deep injections of hyaluronic acid with an adequate swelling factor can contribute to positive changes in skin density, thickness, and firmness through hydration of multiple tissue layers and possibly due to minute amount of filler going into the injection track and traveling towards the skin. And this is important when we are entering this age of considering skin boosters as superficial injections. So in conclusion, the studied HA filler injected with the Pegasus technique supraperiosteal produced improvement in GAIS, skin density, thickness, and firmness at 6 months after the injection. Further studies following these patients to 18 months, are underway.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be discussing follicular unit excision in patients of African descent, a skin-responsive technique by first author Dr. Sanusi Umar and last author Dr. Aaron Nussbaum. Follicular unit excision is a hair transplantation method that avoids the linear scarring typical of other techniques, and it is preferred in men who prefer shorter hairstyles as there is less of a visible scar. In patients of African descent, it is harder to perform this follicular unit excision date because of the higher challenge of their curled hair. Thus, the authors retrospectively analyzed follicular unit excision data at multiple multinational centers using a novel skin-responsive follicular unit excision technique to overcome the problems associated with graft attrition from hair curliness. The goal was to evaluate and retrospectively the performance of a novel skin-responsive follicular unit excision device in patients of African descent at 7 different clinics. The Sanusi follicular unit excision scoring scale was used to assess the follicular unit excision donor area for a difficulty level from 1 to 5, where 5 was the most difficult. There were a total of 64 African-descended patients that had follicular unit excision with this novel device, a mean age of 40, and 28 of them, or almost half, had the very hard or class 5 follicular unit excision sites. The authors recorded the transection rate of the grafts. So this is the percentage of grafts horizontally cut and damaged during the follicular unit excision process. And with this novel device and technique, it was only 3 to 6%. So the authors found that using this new skin-responsive follicular unit excision technique in African descended patients, there was a low transection rate, which is comparable to this procedure performed in non-African descended patients, and thus this procedure can be performed safely in patients with hair curliness in patients of African descent.
My name is Karin Lal, and I will be reviewing successful treatment of keloid with surgical excision followed by pentoxifilin, intralesional corticosteroids, and intralesional 5-FU. This case review is that of a black male with a jawline keloid, which are notably hard to treat. The keloid was first shaved, debulked, and excised with a narrow margin. The dermis prior to closure was injected with 1 cc of 20 mg of Kenalog and 1 cc of 5-FU. The patient was then closed and was started on 400 mg of pentoxifilin twice a day. In the weeks after surgery, the patient received a series of 3 treatments in 2-week intervals consisting of 0.5 cc's of 20 mg of Kenalog into the more hypertrophic areas of the scar, sparing the flat areas, and separately 0.5 cc's of 5-FU injected evenly along the length of the scar. After the 6-week series, the regimen was changed to 0.3 cc's of 20 mg of Kenalog monthly. 3 months later, the frequency of ILK was reduced to 0.3 cc's of 20 mg of cc every 3 months. The patient was continued on pentoxifilin and will be on pentoxifilin for 2 years before tapering. He has had no recurrence at 6 months of follow-up. This goes to show that this combination approach can be super successful in treating keloids. I've done this technique and it works very well with minimal side effects.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the communication, Makeup-Inspired Facial Filler Techniques, Can We Learn from Contouring and Strobing by Fabiano Nadson Machado Vieira. The author points out similarities between makeup and fillers in that both can be used to accentuate lights and shadows on the face. Terms within the makeup industry to describe this include contouring and strobing. Contouring involves using a darker shade of makeup to create the illusion of shadows and depth on the face, particularly between the zygomatic arch and the jawline. This can create a more defined, chiseled look. Strobing involves using a lighter shade to create a luminous and dewy look by highlighting certain areas of the face, including the zygomatic arch, eyebrows, lips, and nasal dorsum. Similar to makeup, fillers can modify contrast, texture, and radiance, as well as volumize and contour different facial areas. Table 1 highlights key approaches to mimic makeup techniques with filler. For example, to get a contouring effect, one may use a viscous HA filler with either a multi-layer sandwich technique or linear cannula threading in treatment areas including the zygomatic arch, temple, jawline, mental protuberance, and lip projection. To stimulate strobing effect, flexible HA fillers or hyperdiluted collagen-stimulating fillers may be used with a fanning cross-hatching technique or deep boluses in areas such as the malar eminence, lateral inferior orbital rim, eyebrow, nasal dorsum, or Cupid's bow. The author points out that some patients have a preconceived notion of the results they want from filler, and using this makeup-inspired approach may help improve patient-physician communication and patient satisfaction. Of note, the author is a regular speaker and participates in the advisory board for Galderma.
I am Curran Lal, and I will be reviewing CO2 laser-assisted avulsion of the proximal nail plate as a new treatment strategy in patients affected by retrochnea. Retrochnea is a very painful condition. This study evaluated the use of CO2 proximal nail avulsion in retrochnea versus total nail plate avulsion. Retrochnea is a common cause of nail bed inflammation, and the treatment can be difficult. While mild cases can be treated conservatively, moderate to severe cases often require surgical management. The authors proposed proximal treatment with CO2 is less traumatic and more precise than total nail avulsion, with less side effects. In the laser group, the nail plate was transversely incised at 5 mm from the proximal nail fold with a single pass of the laser operating in a continuous mode at 10 watts of power according to the nail thickness. Long-term complications were mild bleeding in one patient and paronychia with generation of persistent Bose lines in another patient. No relapses were noted after a follow-up of 10.7 months. After surgery in the surgical group, moderate bleeding was observed in 2 cases and secondary infection occurred in 1 patient. CO2 laser is a safe technique to remove proximal nail plate and relieve the pressure exerted on the matrix by the superimposed nail plates. This is a very procedure-dependent technique and may not be helpful if you haven't been trained in this technique, so it might be worthwhile to look at the images that are noted, and it will depend on what device you use.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the communication, Allogeneic Hair Transplant in a Kidney Transplant Recipient by Felix Popescu and Sanusi Umar. Hair transplants are typically limited by donor hair density. For this reason, using allogeneic hair grafts from another person as a donor is an area of ongoing interest and research. The authors present a case of a 60-year-old man who received a matched kidney allograft from an unrelated friend 20 years ago, who then presented with androgenetic alopecia requesting hair transplant. He had failed to adequately respond to topical minoxidil, oral finasteride, and platelet-rich plasma. He was on long-term, well-tolerated immunosuppression with tacrolimus, mycophenolate, mofetil, and prednisone. Because of hair donor insufficiency, he requested the use of hair from his willing kidney donor. This was considered due to his lifelong immunosuppression for kidney transplant. 2,350 follicular units were harvested from the scalp of the kidney donor and grafted to the kidney recipient. The procedure and recovery period were uneventful, and the recipient had an 85% yield of grafts at 9 months. While there are 2 prior case reports of allogeneic hair transplant in bone marrow transplant recipients, this is the first report in a patient with solid organ transplant. It demonstrates that person-to-person hair transplant may be a viable option between 2 unrelated histocompatible individuals in selected patients who are already requiring lifelong immunosuppressive therapy.
Welcome to Beyond the Digest, offering bonus content covering surgical articles in dermatologic literature outside the peer-reviewed journal Dermatologic Surgery. Reference the episode description for publication details of the content covered.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be reviewing the original investigation entitled Gut Microbiome in Patients with Early Stage and Late Stage Melanoma by Dr. Witt and senior author Dr. Kelly Nelson out of University of Texas MD Anderson. So the gut microbiome gained clinical interest due to its diagnostic and potential therapeutic ability for several diseases and malignancies, including melanoma. In melanoma, an association between the presence of specific microbes in the gut and response to immunotherapy has been demonstrated both in preclinical studies as well as patient cohorts with metastatic disease, but little is known on the microbiome composition in patients with early stage disease and how that compares to both healthy controls as well as patients with later stage melanoma. This was a single center case control study comparing the fecal microbiome or the fecal microbiota, which includes the overall diversity, the composition, and the putative function, between healthy controls, which was 49 patients, and patients with melanoma, which was 179. 38 of those were early stage disease, defined as stage 0 to 2, and 141 were later stage, defined as stage 3 and 4. Microbiome of patients with stage 0 to 2 disease was then compared to the microbiome of patients with stage 3 and 4 disease. The baseline gut microbiota was also explored for association with clinical outcomes in patients with stage 3 melanoma treated with adjuvant immunotherapy. Patients with melanoma were identified from a large prospective cohort study of fecal microbiome in melanoma at MD Anderson. All of the stage 0 to 2 patients were included and matched 1 to 2 with late stage patients based on age, sex, BMI, and race and ethnicity. Patients needed to have been treatment naive prior to stool sample collection. Healthy control patients were volunteers at the hospital. Patient demographic information and concomitant medication use can be seen in Table 1. Of note, control patients were younger, more likely female, and less likely to be on antibiotics, proton pump inhibitors, or statins. Between the early stage and late stage melanoma group, the major difference was that the later stage group was much more likely to be on antibiotics. Fecal sampling collected and was profiled using the 16S ribosomal RNA sequencing. Measures of interest in the fecal microbiota profile included alpha diversity, which is a variability within a single sample, beta diversity, which is variability between different samples in the group, and relative abundance of various microbial taxa. Alpha diversity was found to be higher in the controls versus melanoma patients, although not statistically significant. In terms of beta diversity, the controls compared to melanoma patients form distinct and distant communities. The diversity difference was primarily driven by the phyla actinomycetota and Firmicutes, which was much more abundant in the controls. Fusobacterium, which has been implicated in colorectal cancer carcinogenesis, was interestingly enriched in the melanoma cohort in a univariate analysis, but this was attenuated in the covariate analysis. When comparing early stage patients with late stage patients, early stage patients had significantly higher alpha diversity as well as differences in beta diversity, which can be seen in figure 3C. The bacterial genus Rosaburia was found to be in greater abundance in early stage disease, although this was again attenuated with a covariate analysis. Lastly, the authors investigated baseline microbiome features in patients with stage 3 disease who underwent adjuvant immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy and were then followed. 30% experienced recurrence and alpha diversity was higher in those patients. There was no difference in beta diversity and no significant difference in bacterial taxa. Inability to control for co-founders like diet, lifestyle, and medication use is a limitation for all observational microbiome studies, but this study identified key features of the gut dysbiosis in patients with melanoma, which adds to this ever-evolving picture of the complex interplay between the skin and gut.
This is Yessel Kim, and I'll be reviewing an original investigation in September's JAD, Outcomes of Invasive Melanoma of the Head and Neck Treated with Mohs Micrographic Surgery, a multi-center study by first author Brandon Beal and senior author David Brodlin. There is a gap in knowledge of outcomes data on invasive melanomas of the head and neck treated with Mohs micrographic surgery. Therefore, the authors aim to determine local recurrence, nodal recurrence, and distant recurrence rates, and disease-specific survival for invasive melanomas of the head and neck treated with Mohs using MART1 immunohistochemical stains. This retrospective study was performed at two clinical sites at Zittelli and Broadlands and the University of Pennsylvania. All patients treated with Mohs using frozen sections with MART1 were enrolled over a 12-year period from 2005 to 2017. Patient outcomes were determined from the last physical exam documented in the EMR or from phone calls. The patients were asked about new lesions at the scar or if their doctor had diagnosed metastatic melanoma. When patients could not be reached by phone, outcomes were determined from the last physical exam documented by a dermatologist. Patients diagnosed with biopsy-proven primary invasive melanomas of the head and neck without evidence of metastatic disease on presentation who received treatment with Mohs using MART1 were included. The primary outcome was local recurrence rates. Secondary outcome was nodal recurrence and distal recurrence metastases rates and overall and disease-specific mortality rates. Both institutions follow the same protocol of starting with a 6 mm initial margin for the first stage of Mohs unless it was in an area of critical functional anatomic locations for which the margin was reduced to 3 mm. The average patient age was 69.4 years, 71% were men, 785 invasive melanomas of the head and neck were included. Median follow-up was 37.9 months. 81% of the tumors were less than or equal to 1 mm in basal depth. Overall, local recurrence rate was 0.51%, nodal recurrence was 1%, and distant recurrence was 1.1%. Overall, melanoma-specific death was 2.4%. Disease-specific 5-year survival was 96.8%, and 10-year survival was 93.4%. Those with any type of recurrence had deeper tumors compared to those without recurrence. Those with nodal recurrence were found to have ulceration more frequently than tumors without recurrence, but ulceration was not associated with overall or melanoma-specific mortality. Basal depth was associated with melanoma-specific death. Location of tumor was also associated with melanoma-specific death, with the location on the scalp carrying a worse prognosis than other sites. This study showed that Mohs with MART1 of invasive melanomas had overall local recurrence, nodal recurrence, and distant recurrence rates of about 1%, which is better than what is reported in the literature of special site melanomas treated with complete excision with a local recurrence rate approaching 10%. Therefore, Mohs should be viewed as a treatment option for invasive melanomas of the head and neck and support modification to the NCCN guidelines for the treatment of invasive melanomas of the head and neck. Limitations of the study is that it is a non-randomized retrospective study and it did not compare Mohs versus complete excision. Furthermore, sentinel lymph node biopsy information was not captured in this study, and the study also assumed the last physical exam by a dermatologist when they could not reach the patient by phone, so there is a potential that not all the recurrences were recaptured.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be reviewing the commentary entitled The Gut Microbiome and Melanoma, a piece of a complex puzzle that I wrote with Dr. Amanda Nelson. This commentary was in response to the paper by Witt et al. That I reviewed, and it gives a background of the gut microbiome and its relationship to melanoma. The gut contains about 1 trillion commensal microorganisms, including viruses, archaea, bacteria, and unicellular eukaryotes. The bacterial component is by far the largest and most well studied, using the 16S ribosomal RNA sequencing. Some defining terms when thinking about the microbiome include alpha diversity, which describes the richness or the number of unique species in a single sample, while beta diversity describes differences between population samples.
cells. The term gut dysbiosis describes a deviation from normal composition. Gut dysbiosis and loss of alpha diversity have been found in several disease states, including melanoma, but what role it played in disease progression was unanswered. Witt et al. Showed that alpha diversity trended higher in healthy controls compared to patients with melanoma, and when stratified between early and late stage disease, loss of alpha diversity was seen in the later stage patients. This suggests that loss of diversity may be associated with disease progression. The question we still have with microbiome studies is continuing to define gut dysbiosis and how this can affect patients prognostically, therapeutically, or both. We briefly review a healthy gut microbiome, which is challenging in itself to define given the innate heterogeneity among individuals. The dominant phyla are Bacteroidetes and Firmicutes, with actinobacteria and proteobacteria contributing a smaller portion. Heritable and environmental factors like age, sex, diet, medication, and geographic location has a large impact on microbiome variation, which is why it's so challenging to make comparisons in observational studies. How gut dysbiosis contributes to melanoma is still being investigated. Evidence supports the hypothesis that gut microbes help break down complex polysaccharides, which help to promote the gut barrier. If the gut barrier is disruptive, gut microbes and metabolites are released, inciting an inflammatory response that can help facilitate disease states. Several studies have shown that key bacterial taxa have been associated with response to immune checkpoint inhibitors in melanoma patients, but there's no key bacteria taxa that has been consistent across all studies. The consistent association between therapeutic response and microbiome composition does support the notion that altering the microbiome could indeed improve response. This has been shown in both preclinical and early phase 1 clinical studies with fecal microbiome transplants. Other targeted therapies to alter the gut microbiome, including pre- and probiotics, may prove to influence clinical response as well. The challenge, though, and what is still unknown, is if these interventions have the ability to outcompete essentially the pathogenic bacteria and alter the gut microbiome long term. Ultimately, it is important to remember that microbiome studies identify an association, not a causation. No studies have been able to delineate whether gut dysbiosis is a cause, a consequence, or both of disease states. An innate challenge with all microbiome studies, and this was discussed in the Witt et al. Paper, is the inability to control exposures that individuals experience, which are known to affect the microbiome, but the degree to which they do or the impact they have is unknown. The microbiome is clearly a crucial piece of the puzzle in our health, and papers like Witt et al. Continue to unlock some of the relationships between the gut microbiome and diseases like melanoma.
This is Kim Matosko, and I'll be reviewing Asian American and Pacific Islander patients with melanoma have an increased odds of treatment delay, a cross-sectional study by first author Lauren Fain and last author Jeremy Bordeaux in September's issue of JAD. Although skin of color patients have a lower incidence of melanoma, the mortality from the diagnosis is significantly higher than white patients. The study evaluated the National Cancer Database to determine if Asian American and Pacific Islander patients have a longer time from diagnosis to definitive surgery. Authors looked at records of over 300,000 patients with cutaneous melanoma, of which 1,155 were Asian American and Pacific Islander. The rest were non-Hispanic white. Compared to non-Hispanic white patients, Asian American and Pacific Islander patients presented at younger ages with later stage melanoma. Compared to non-Hispanic white patients, Asian American and Pacific Islander patients had a longer average time from diagnosis to definitive surgery for stage 1, 2, and 3 melanoma. Adjusting for socio-demographic factors, Asian American and Pacific Islander patients had 1.5 times the odds of time from diagnosis to definitive treatment between 61 and 90 days, and twice the odds of time from diagnosis to definitive treatment of greater than 90 days. These findings persisted in Medicare and private insurance types. Uninsured Asian American and Pacific Islander patients had the longest time from diagnosis to definitive treatment, while those with private insurance had the shortest time from diagnosis to definitive treatment. In conclusion, Asian American and Pacific Islander patients have increased odds of treatment delays, even after controlling for socio-demographic and disease characteristics. Awareness of these disparities are important for propelling efforts to improve melanoma detection and treatment and reducing racial disparities.
This is Tara Jennings, and I will be reviewing the Research Letter Online Risk Calculator and Nomogram for Predicting Sentinel Lymph Node Positivity in Merkel Cell Carcinoma by first author Nolan Malone and senior author Lisa Zaba. The NCCN guidelines for clinically node-negative Merkel cell carcinoma without distant mets recommend surgery and sentinel lymph node biopsy with consideration of adjuvant radiation based on specific patient risk factors. Despite this, recent literature shows that patients receiving guideline-compliant primary tumor excision and lymph node evaluation has plateaued at approximately 50% since 2012. The aim of the study was to investigate how the risk of sentinel lymph node positivity is influenced by pathologic features in order to help estimate the risk of sentinel lymph node biopsy status and help guide decisions regarding adjuvant treatment in the setting of non-diagnostic sentinel lymph node biopsy. Authors performed a retrospective review of 2,766 clinically node-negative early-stage Merkel cell carcinoma patients from 2012 to 2017 who underwent sentinel lymph node biopsy. They used the National Cancer Database for this study. Results of the multivariate logistic regression analysis showed that primary site, presence of lymphovascular invasion, tumor size and immunosuppression due to a history of CLL or transplant were found to be independent predictors of sentinel lymph node biopsy positivity. From this information, a nomogram was created which incorporated these features to estimate the probability of sentinel lymph node metastasis. The C-index of this model was comparable with other established melanoma nomograms and demonstrated excellent calibration. Authors then used this nomogram to create an online risk calculator where clinicians can enter a patient's tumor size, primary site, and presence or absence of lymphovascular invasion and immunosuppression to calculate risk for a specific patient. The calculator is available at the hyperlink on the online text. I applaud the authors as I believe this can be a great resource for clinicians to both reinforce the importance of lymph node evaluation in Merkel cell carcinoma and help guide adjuvant treatment discussions in non-diagnostic or false negative sentinel lymph node biopsies.
This is Kim and Tosco, and I'll be reviewing high-risk prognostic tumor features of squamous cell carcinomas in organ transplant patients compared with the general population in the August issue of JAMA Dermatology. We know that immunosuppressed organ transplant patients are at significantly higher risk of squamous cell carcinoma compared to the general population. Because of the significant morbidity and mortality that SCC causes in organ transplant patients, it is believed these tumors to be more aggressive in these patients. This study quantifies the relative prevalence of five core clinicopathologic indicators of poor SCC outcomes, namely cephalic location, perineural invasion, invasion to and beyond the subcutaneous fat, poor differentiation, and tumor size greater than 20 millimeters in each group. Patient data was extracted from two prospective studies to include 741 SCCs excised from 191 organ transplant patients and compared to 2,558 SCCs from 1,507 non-organ transplant patients in the general population. SCCs developed most frequently on the head and neck in the organ transplant population, but on the arms and hands in the general population. After adjusting for age and sex, perineural invasion was more than twice as common in organ transplant recipients as in the general population cases, as was invasion to and beyond the subcutaneous fat. Poorly versus well-differentiated SCCs were more than threefold more common in organ transplant recipients and prevalence of tumors greater than 20 millimeters versus 20 millimeters or smaller was moderately higher in organ transplant recipients. Overall, this dual cohort study showed SCCs in the organ transplant recipients to possess significantly worse high-risk histopathologic features than SCCs in the general population.
This is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing a research letter in September's JAD, Diagnosis of Perineural Invasion During Mohs Micrographic Surgery Guides Clinical Decision-Making in the Management of Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinoma by first author Alexa Storer and senior author Mary Stevenson. Mohs micrographic surgery allows for identification of high-risk histologic features compared to initial biopsies, which provides intraoperative information that may influence management and patient outcomes. The authors investigated the identification of perineural invasion on initial biopsy compared to Mohs to highlight the impact of Mohs on clinical decision-making. Among 2149 cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas treated at NYU from 2019 to 2022, 18 histologically confirmed cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas with perineural invasion on biopsy or Mohs were included. Perineural invasion was identified in 11% of lesions on initial biopsy, 11% on biopsy and Mohs, and in 78% during Mohs alone. A third of lesions had large caliber perineural invasion, and all diagnoses of large caliber perineural invasion were made during Mohs. Staging information obtained during Mohs resulted in recommendation of postoperative radiation in 11 of the 18 cases with perineural invasion, including all large caliber perineural invasion lesions and 41.7% of small caliber perineural invasion lesions that were either poorly differentiated or had deep invasion. 70% of patients with perineural invasion completed the recommended postoperative radiation. There were no cases of local recurrence with an average follow-up of 14 months. Poor outcomes were found in 3 patients, all with large caliber perineural invasion. 2 of these patients did not receive the recommended radiation, and 1 patient received the radiation but was immunosuppressed. In conclusion, perineural invasion was identified during Mohs 89% of the time, and 78% of the tumors had perineural invasion diagnosed solely during Mohs. Diagnosis of perineural invasion on Mohs led to the recommendation of postoperative radiation in over 60% of cases, 70% of whom completed radiation. This study, therefore, further supports the value of pathologic staging data obtained at Mohs as superior to biopsy data alone in recognizing risk stratifying features, which affords a real-time influence on clinical decision-making regarding imaging, choice or timing of closure, and additional interventions.
This is Tara Jennings, and I will be reviewing the original investigation, Patient Preferences for Pain Control After Mohs Micrographic Surgery, a Single-Center Discrete Choice Experiment, by first author Shannon Nugent and senior author Serene Giordano. In the United States, 26% of patients who underwent Mohs micrographic surgery from January 2009 to June 2020 filled an opioid prescription. This peaked in 2011 with 39.6% of patients and decreased annually thereafter to 11.7% in 2020. Authors point out that in other specialties, minor surgical procedures have been associated with increased incidence of long-term opioid use. This study was designed to understand how patients weigh the potential benefit of improved pain control versus the risk of opioid addiction to determine the overall preferences for pain control after Mohs surgery. This was a prospective discrete choice experiment conducted at the University of Pennsylvania from August 2021 to April 2022. Of note, discrete choice experiments are utilized to understand patient preferences in healthcare and to quantify the relative importance that patients allocate to various treatment attributes. The discrete choice experiment described here presents 12 different scenarios to the respondents. Each scenario had 2 hypothetical pain management options, the first being opioids plus over-the-counter medications, and the second being over-the-counter medications only. Each of these options had corresponding risk profiles for pain and addiction. The over-the-counter plus opioids option had the pain profile of 0, indicating no pain, 3, indicating pain that is distracting, and 8, indicating pain that limits physical activity. The addiction risk profile was 0%, 2%, 6%, and 12%. the only over-the-counter option had a pain level of 0, 3, and 8 again, and the risk of addiction of 0% and 2%. As we know, there's no risk of addiction with over-the-counter medications, but 2% was used as a value to permit adequate statistical overlap and comparison between the medication groups. The primary outcome was median risk equivalence, defined as the pain level at which 50% of respondents would choose over-the-counter plus opioids with a given risk of addiction profile. Of the 295 respondents, 101 or 34% stated that they would never consider opioids for pain management, regardless of the pain level experienced. And 147% of patients, or 50%, expressed concern regarding possible opioid addiction. Across all scenarios, 224 respondents, or 76%, preferred only over-the-counter medications after Mohs surgery for pain control. When the theoretical risk of addiction was low at 0%, half of the respondents expressed a preference for over-the-counter plus opioids, given a pain level of 6.5 on that 10-point scale. At higher opioid addiction profiles, being the 2%, 6%, or 12% scenarios, an equal preference for over-the-counter plus opioids and only over-the-counters was not achieved. In these scenarios, patients favored only over-the-counter medications despite experiencing higher pain levels. In summary, the study showed that as the theoretical risk of opioid addiction increased, patients preferred only over-the-counter medications despite high levels of pain. This indicates that the risk of opioid addiction is associated with the patient's choice of pain medications after Mohs surgery. Importantly, authors mentioned that their study included a high percentage of healthcare workers with high education and household income, and that the findings of the study may not be generalizable to the larger population. They also note that these surveys may not reflect actual behavior, but rather act as a data gathering tool regarding implicit decisions.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the original article in the Journal of American Dermatology entitled Host and Primary Tumor Factors for the Development of Multiple Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinomas Among a Retrospective Cohort in Rhode Island by first author Isabel Mosley and senior author Dr. Cho. The article begins by providing the background that while risk factors for a primary cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma are well established, the host and primary tumor risk factors for subsequent cutaneous squamous cells have not been fully explored. This was a retrospective chart review of patients diagnosed with squamous cell skin cancer in an academic dermatology clinic in Rhode Island from 2016 to 2019 in order to evaluate the associations between risk factors in the host and multiple cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas, and between primary tumor characteristics and the risk of subsequent squamous cell development. Adjusted odds ratios and confidence intervals were calculated. A total of 1,312 patients with squamous cell diagnoses were included. Host risk factors significantly associated with multiple squamous cells included age over 80 years, history of solid organ transplant, history of skin cancer, history of other cancer, family history of skin cancer, and actinic keratoses. Tumor location, diameter, and histologic differentiation, as well as treatment, were not significant predictors of subsequent squamous cells. Limitations included that the study was predominantly in white Caucasian patients from a single institution. Authors conclude that certain host characteristics were associated with the development of subsequent squamous cell carcinomas, which may inform clinical guidelines for follow-up.
Thank you for listening to Derm Surgery Digest, the official podcast of the Dermatologic Surgery Journal. To access these featured articles, author videos, and much more, visit journals.lww.com/dermatologicsurgery. To learn more about the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery, visit asds.net.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing
the usefulness of ultrasound in varicose venous malformation, a series of 103 cases by its first author, Dr. Zhao Gong, and last author, Lixin Wang from China. So varicose hemangiomas are now called varicose venous malformations. They're a type of venous malformation that is a rare congenital vascular anomaly, presents at birth or early childhood, and it grows with the patient. It's usually unilateral and usually in the lower extremities and defined as a subcutaneous mass. There are only a few studies on ultrasound imaging of these varicose venous malformations, and thus the authors' goal was to show the distinctive ultrasound feature of these anomalies and to improve the accuracy of clinical diagnosis with Doppler and ultrasound imaging. So this is a retrospective review of 103 patients diagnosed with a varicose venous malformation, and most presented as immobile, solitary, or multiple hyperkeratotic plaques or nodules. And further findings, they found that on ultrasound, 98% of lesions showed subcutaneous fat infiltration. And then another, about 5%, were only in the subcutaneous layer with no skin involvement. Most of the lesions were hyperechoic on ultrasound, and calcifications were present in 5.7%, and visible vessels in 10.7% of cases. Interestingly, previous reports have shown that these varicose venous malformations are circumcised, minimally lobulated, and subcutaneous masses. However, in this study, they found that these lesions were in the dermal and subcutaneous layer, with only about 4.9% in the subcutaneous layer. Furthermore, the varicose venous malformations were found to be variable solid echinogenicity, with 96.1% being hypoechoic and 1.2% being hypoechoic. Thus, in this study, hopefully the authors have demonstrated clinical and ultrasound diagnosis. They've shown that there's a heterogeneous hyperechoicity as a solid mass with ill-defined margins on ultrasound, low vessel density, and venous flow on color Doppler. And these can help physicians make a more accurate diagnosis of this rare venous anomaly. This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reporting on successful management of extensive cruciform facial scarring secondary to patch syndrome with a combination of medical and surgical treatments by first author Allison Yan and last author Benjamin Kaffenberger. So patch syndrome is the trio of pyoderma gangrenosum, acne, and hidradenitis suppurativa. And the authors report a case of patch syndrome where they used high dose, high frequency infliximab and surgical management of scars to improve facial scarring secondary to this inflammatory condition. So this is a 35-year-old man, history of Crohn's and patch. He had failed adalimumab, which he developed antibodies, and supposedly infliximab, which had lost efficacy. And also noted azathioprine and prednisone were ineffective. And thus, a high-dose, high-frequency infliximab infusion of 10 mg per kg every 4 weeks was performed, including stage deroofing procedures that included deroofing with the tract with a 15-blade, electrocyclation curettage, and dermabrasion. And no pathology was reported. A year and a half later, the patient had significant improvement in the scars and quality of life. So, patch syndrome is a very rare autoimmune condition that can cause scarring. The concern with this is pathology due to the pyoderma gangrenosum. This case illustrates that there can be improvement in inflammation and scarring using the high-dose, high-frequency infliximab infusions, as well as dermabrasion and deroofing procedures, and no pathology was seen. This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing efficacy and safety of precision cryotherapy to treat seborrheic dermatitis of the scalp by first author Young Chow and last author Won-Sir Kim. So the authors use a new cryotherapy device with precision control
to negative 5 degrees Celsius on the skin to treat seborrheic dermatitis. And they thought that this would modulate the immune response to it. This was a single arm open label prospective study. And patients were scheduled to undergo 3 precision cryotherapy treatments at 2-week intervals and then 2 additional visits at weeks 6 and 8. And basically, this device was performed to the entire scalp after setting the target temperature of negative 5 degrees Celsius, and total treatment time was approximately 240 to 360 seconds. At each visit, pruritus was assessed, as well as a visual analog score, global physician assessment, and also they were measuring erythema index and water loss. So in total, 24 patients were enrolled and received the 3 precision cryotherapy interventions 2 weeks apart. And there were improvements in physician global assessment, and itch score decreased by 50.4% by week 8. There's also an average erythema index decrease by 19% as well. So this study shows that there is demonstrated efficacy and safety of precision cryotherapy in scalp seborrheic dermatitis. And the authors discussed that perhaps some of the mechanisms behind this include an immunoregulatory response. And the authors use negative 5 degrees because this is above the cell destruction threshold, causing apoptosis of the cells in the seborrheic dermatitis lesions and inducing immune tolerance or immune suppression, rather than an inflammatory response during necrosis. For instance, keratinocytes and fibroblasts need negative 20 to negative 30 degrees Celsius to cause cell destruction. Thus, this study shows that precision cryotherapy can be added as a possible treatment for scalp seborrheic dermatitis. Usually 3 treatments are needed, and side effects were minimal.